This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. As the song says, it's the most wonderful time of the year. But amid the hustle and bustle of the holidays, it's worthwhile to remember this is also a great time of year to take stock of your investments and see what options you have before January 1st to reduce the taxes you'll owe come April 15th. Here to explore year-end tax strategies that could let you keep more of your money are David Foster, Senior Vice President at Foster & Motley, and local financial advisor Chris DeSimio. Chris and Dave, good to see you this afternoon.
Always good to be here, Mark.
Yeah, pleasure.
You can call in with your questions about tax strategies for the end of the year. The phone number is 513-419-7100. You can also email them to talk@wvxu.org, or you can post them on Facebook or Twitter. And Chris, first, let's start off by taking a look at the numbers. And the biggie today is the monthly jobs report, which turned out to be quite good, didn't it?
Much better than expected. The rate itself came in at 5.8%, which was about in line. But the consensus for the non-farm payrolls, they were looking for about 220 or so. And that number was 341,000. Not only was that number a lot bigger, but September and October figures were revised upward by 44,000. So there's this lagging effect that thinking that perhaps some of the people who are doing the counting of the numbers, that they're having trouble keeping up with it. Because remember, there's a gap between private and public payrolls. Private job growth has been really strong, and government job growth has not been as strong. So maybe at the Department of Labor, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, there are enough people to count this stuff, which could be what's behind these revisions.
So the number was for November was just way above average,
yep,
wasn't it?
That is correct.
Usually it's around 230, 240, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Well, that's what the consensus is. But maybe this is a pretty long string now of numbers above 200,000 job growth. And so the question that is coming up on the street now is the economy strong enough for the Fed to take the training wheels off? And if you were watching the futures this morning, they were up. And then when that number came out, they flinched a little bit. It was like a big gust of wind blowing a willow tree over a little bit. And then when they looked at the revisions for September and October, then it came back up. So there is a sense growing that maybe the economy is, in fact, doing okay, not for everyone, and it's still not great, but the talk or fear of a recession seems to have resided somewhat.
So you're saying this could be the green light the Federal Reserve has been waiting for to raise interest rates?
Well, until we get another yellow light. You know, the Fed has always said that they're going to be data dependent. And with the weakness from overseas markets, with some of the manufacturing figures in Europe and Germany slowing down and numbers being lowered, the Fed now has almost this little umbrella because rates in Europe are so low that they may not have to raise them that much. And plus, commodity prices continue to come under pressure because of falling oil prices. And so they're not as concerned about inflation as they otherwise would be when the economy is starting to heat up again.
Well, speaking of oil prices, what effect is that having on the economy? It has to be pretty positive.
Well, it's certainly not hurting some things. When you think of now you can fill your tank for about $2.70 a gallon, it doesn't even have to have ethanol in it to be cheap anymore. There's a sense that some of that money that otherwise had been spent at the pump might be getting spent at the mall. And so you were seeing some retailers, certain retail companies are doing quite well. They're reporting fairly strong numbers. Of course, just like last year, if you remember, whatever number we got in January, February, March was always, the caveat was, well, wait a minute, it was the weather that did it. So the first big weekend of shopping, there's massive storm right out of the Old Testament. settled in over the East Coast. I drove through it. It was pretty exciting. It was pretty exciting. So that may have influenced some of those numbers.
Do you think the oil prices maybe played a little bit in the jobs numbers too? Perhaps businesses feel like they have a little bit more money so they can afford to hire people?
You know, that'll be known later on. That could be one of the reasons, because if you're not spending as much to power your plant, to turn the lights on, to keep the place heated, you now have a little more room. But this cliff they've fallen off has been so recently that perhaps it may not have you know, played that big a part yet. But if they stay low for a long time, that could be an influence. So keep in mind that depending on what studies you read, the combination of horizontal drilling and other oil extraction techniques, some of which are not popular, some are controversial, but the fact is that there are two fields now in the state of Texas alone, the Permian Basin and the Eagle Ford Shale, that according to some analysts, those two places alone have as much oil and gas as six Saudi Arabias. And if that's the case, then you add in the Bakken Formation, the Utica Shale, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot more supply than there used to be. And since oil business is transacted all around the world in dollars, if there's a lot, if oil prices are going down because of an increased supply, that alone is enough to push the dollar higher. And that has ripple effects. It hurts U.S. exporters, a strong dollar does. And so it's tending to cause investors to focus more on domestic companies, companies that make or sell stuff here in the United States.
Any other numbers we should be looking for, Chris?
Oh, we've had our fill of numbers. There've been so many
numbers. Of numbers.
But I will tell you that the non-farm productivity, this is interesting. Productivity figures released were up 2.3%. That was in line with estimates, but the unit labor cost figures. This is one of those kind of arcane numbers released 2 days ago. They were expected to be up 0.1% or down 0.9%. Actually, they were down 1% unit labor costs. So the cost of making stuff is getting cheaper. And that's generally a pretty good sign.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. And Dave, you and I were talking earlier. You said this is a busy time of year for you.
Yes,
that's all the people making their year-end tax strategies, putting those in place, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just wondering about what they ought to be doing that, you know, they've thought about for 11 months but haven't done anything about.
You know, I'm always stressed out come tax time, and I imagine a lot of other people feel the same way. So there are actually things that I can do now to make April 15th a little less stressful, correct?
Sure.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that you recommend people do?
Yeah, probably the biggest thing is just try and do a tax projection somehow. Just get it down on paper. A lot of people have no idea whether they're going to owe a bunch of money in April or not. And just sort of that knowledge is often really nice just to, oh, maybe I got a refund coming or I'm going to owe some money. But so if you just do a projection, whether you can do that on your own, you know, TurboTax software, whether you've got a CPA or an accountant that helps you. And then once you've got that, then you can look at planning strategies.
What about trying to offset losses and gains? A lot at this time of year, a lot of people will say, well, okay, I've booked such and such a gains or I have this much in losses. And in fact, some of these tax programs do a really good job of keeping track. If you have any old tax loss carryforwards, mm-hmm. from if you rebalance your portfolio in the wake of the financial crisis 6 years ago, you may have that hidden asset of a tax loss carry forward that you might not know about. How big a role do those play in your year-end tax planning?
Yeah, they play a big role, though I think there's some real misconceptions around that, too. So the first thing is, it's important to know, you know, if, for example, let's say you've got significant capital gains and you have the opportunity to also take some losses. Maybe you've got a couple stocks or a couple mutual funds that are down. It might be wise to go ahead and capture some losses between now and the end of the year if you want to offset some gains that you've already taken. That makes sense. Generally, the one place it doesn't, and we see this a lot, is like, you know, there's this rule that if your taxable income for, let's say, a married couple up to about $75,000, up to about that level for a married couple filing jointly, if you have capital gains, the tax rate is zero. Okay, so you don't want to run around and create capital losses to wipe out something that you don't pay tax on anyway. So
they're I happen to have with me my handy dandy tax reference guide.
But I hate to take a loss. I just don't want to take a loss, though, Chris.
I know that. But it's just a paper loss. But what Dave is saying that you may not need to, because if your taxable income is under the rate, is under $73,800 this year, and that's the taxable income. That's mm-hmm. after you've applied your deductions and exemptions.
Correct.
Then your capital gains are zero. So just let it go. What happens, though, what happens if you have a taxable gain, a capital gain, that then causes you to get into a higher bracket, or even at 73.8, if you're getting Social Security, some of these capital gains could cause you, or is it possible that taking capital gains could cause you to have to pay more taxes on your Social Security income if you're receiving it?
Yes. Yes, which is what makes this...
Don't try this at home, folks.
Sometimes it drives me crazy because, I mean, years ago, I could almost give tax advice sort of off the cuff. Like people say, what if I do this? Oh, well, that. Not anymore. I mean, I have to put everything into my tax planning software and because there's just so many breakpoints and phase outs. And so, yes, I mean, to answer your question directly, it could be really expensive to recognize a capital gain if somebody has pretty low taxable income otherwise and is getting Social Security. It could be a 50% marginal rate. But you got to crunch the numbers to actually do it.
Hey, Chris, help this layman out here. I'm sitting here thinking, you know, what's the benefit of selling something at a loss instead of holding on and hoping and praying that you get a profit out of it?
Well, first of all,
is that kind of foolish to hope you get the profit back out of it?
Hope is rarely an investment strategy. hope is prevalent and rampant this time of year. But keep in mind that they're among the many colorful sayings on Wall Street is that the stock doesn't care that you own it. Stock doesn't know that you own it. You may think it does, but it doesn't. And if you have gains, and if you've checked with your own tax software or with an accountant such as Dave, then sometimes if you know you're going to be in a high gain and you have losses, then sometimes it makes sense to book it, even though you'd rather not, to offset the tax on the gains. That being said, keep in mind, and this is why we're so glad that Dave is here, because there are certain rules that apply to booking a loss that you can't, because quite frequently, it's DeSimio's corollary to Murphy's Law. If you sell a stock for the wrong reason, it will sometimes, not sometimes, it will always go up just because you sold it. So sometimes they do know that you own it because they get offended. And so you have to stay out of it for a certain number of days, both before and after. It used to be just after. Now it's both before and after. You can't be buying shares of something that you've sold to book a tax loss. It's called the wash rules. How do those work, Dave?
You're basically right. You got this 30-day window. Or is it 60 days? Heck, no, I can't remember. It's 30 days.
30 days either side.
Yeah, either side. Where if you want to take a loss, obviously you can't sell your IBM shares at a loss today, for example, and then 3 days later try and buy them back. I mean, the IRS says, no.
A wash sale.
That's called a wash sale. And you can't do it before. So basically you got this 60-day window where you don't want to be doing that stuff.
And what happens if you say, okay, I'm gonna sell it and book the loss in my taxable account, but I'm going to buy them right back in my IRA?
Yeah, I can't do that. Used to think we could do that, but the IRS has kind of said, no, don't want to do that. To go back to one of your points, Mark, I mean, to me, one of the most fundamental rules here is don't do anything generally just because for a tax reason. Like that stock that has a loss, if you want to sell it because you don't think it's a good investment anymore, sell it. If you don't want to sell because you think it has a great upside, but you can get a little tax gain, I probably wouldn't do it. Don't let the tax, rules associated with...
Don't let that drive your investment decisions.
Yeah. I mean, it's generally, we're just talking deferral here. I mean, someday you're going to either pay the tax or get the benefit, so...
Yeah, don't let the tax tail wag the investment
exactly.
dog.
Exactly, yeah.
After the break, we'll continue to look at the things you need to do before the end of the year to make sure you don't get an unwelcome surprise on April 15th. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. We'll take your phone calls as well, 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining me this afternoon are financial advisor Chris DeSimio and David Foster, Senior Vice President of Foster & Motley, as we talk about year-end tax strategies. Yes, what you do now can have a profound effect when you file next year. And you can join the conversation with your questions at 513-419-7100. And also you can email your questions to talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter and post your questions and comments there. But let's talk with Doug in Glendale. Good afternoon, Doug. Thanks for hanging on the line. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Thanks. This is a question about a trust. It concerns a disabled person who's had a trust for a while. He reached the age of 40 and can now end the trust. The trust is funded by an annuity through Genworth. And I'm just wondering, having this, you know, check come to him, probably around $90,000, is this going to create a taxing event for him?
The check, is that the principal value of the trust, or is that like an annual annuity, Doug?
That's exactly right. It's an annual annuity check, and it'll, you know, it'll be approximately $90,000
per year.
Exactly. Yes, sir.
From the trust.
Well, I'll tell you what. It increases by 4% each year.
Well, that's a complicated one because it depends on what kind of annuity it is. Assuming it's a non-qualified annuity, meaning it was never funded with retirement benefits. So it's a non-qualified. So somebody someday put a chunk of money into it. I'm making up numbers here. You know, $500,000. If it's worth $900,000 at the time it got annuitized, then some portion of every dollar that you're getting back is a return of the original investment. Some portion's taxable. There's really, we can't answer that.
Yeah, but, and I guess the question also would be, and I wish we had an attorney, Jay Brinker, was here.
Yeah.
We really, it's for both of them. But if that, if the trust owns the annuity, then there are, aren't there other rules that come into effect at the trust level first? Mm-hmm. The trust has tax issues, and then the person who's the beneficiary of the trust has a different set of issues. Isn't that the case?
That's true. The first thing that came to my mind, Doug, when you were talking was, a lot of times these things stay in trust to allow these folks to have access to potentially government benefits. And if it comes out of a trust, that could impact somebody who has special needs, their ability to get government benefits. So it's a kind of it's a pretty complex area. I don't know if any of those are kind of issues you're dealing with, but man, that's a tough one to answer, honestly.
Yeah. Doug, do you have good conversations with the people who are managing the trust, with the trustees?
You know, the problem is this. You know, of course, we're here in Ohio, and this trust was in Rhode Island, and Bank of America, mm-hmm. there's no branches here.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a real difficult transition.
Yes.
And,
okay.
I guess the thing is, this trust, the whole thing started because he was injured at birth, and there was a lawsuit, and then a sum of money.
Structured settlement is what this is.
That would be tax free.
Yes.
Okay. Structured settlement proceeds are tax free.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I was thinking about that when you described that. It almost sounded as if it were some kind of structured settlement, which
okay,
are
great.
Frequently well, funded with annuities. But check with your own trusted tax advisor first.
You sound relieved, Doug.
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the
great.
Phone call.
Your help.
We appreciate it. And if you have questions you'd like to call in, 513-419-7100. And Chris, you can email, right?
Yeah. You can, in fact, email. And we have some unfinished business. The last time we were here, we got a lot of calls, and we had to leave some calls dangling. So we encourage you to call in before we get too much further into the show. We also had some email questions that we didn't get to. And one of them actually is right in Mr. David Foster, CFP CPA's wheelhouse. And that is, explain how a stretch IRA works. What is a stretch IRA, and how do they work?
So a stretch IRA is the term used to describe how an IRA can outlive its owner after the owner's death for a long, long time. So the simplest way to describe a stretch IRA is, let's say you've got a widow or a widower, you know, 80 years old, has an IRA, names perhaps even his grandchildren or one grandchild, age 20, as the beneficiary. If the grandchild does the right things with that, like rolls it over to their own inherited IRA, they can take it out over their life expectancy. So a 20-year-old might have a life expectancy of 60 years. So then you can take out 1/60th in the year following your grandfather's death, and then 1/59th. So if you put that on like Excel spreadsheet, it's a big number.
Yeah. Now, Dave, is there a way that grandpa and grandma can compel the apple of their eye, little Junior, to take it out according to the IRS formula? Because a lot of these inherited IRAs allow the beneficiary to just, yes, they can defer it and be on that schedule, but they also, in many cases, have the ability to just dip in and say, oh, there's my Maserati that I've been coveting. So can grandma and grandpa keep Junior from getting the Maserati?
Short of haunting, you know, at a later date, no, it's pretty tough. No, you could create a trust, and that's a whole other thing. And but you're right that there is that danger because the custodian of the IRA cannot. I mean, the beneficiary can come in and say, "Hey, I know I only have to take $1,200, but I'd like to take all $100,000." Nothing you can do about it.
Normally,
other than a trust. I mean, you can lock it up in a trust.
Normally on an inherited IRA, you have to have it out in what? Is it 5 years? Is that the typical?
You know, the rules have gotten better. If you kind of mess it up, then, yeah, it has to be 5 years. But if you actually can get it rolled over into somebody's inherited IRA, then you have the life expectancy of whoever that beneficiary is.
Right, and even if you're under age 59 and a half, even though this says an IRA account and it's the, you know, so-and-so beneficiary of the so-and-so's IRA, the penalties that normally apply at age 59 and a half are waived. Is that not the case?
Now, the biggest mistake that I see in this area that happens all the time is somebody, you know, a grandparent or a parent dies, and maybe they don't have a large IRA. They just have, you know, whatever. It's not a huge part of the estate. Often when the estate is being wrapped up, they'll go to the kids and say, hey, you know, you're entitled to a third of this. Can we just give you a check? And the kids will say, well, okay. And no one says to them, you know, you can roll this over to an IRA. And if you get that check, it's over. You can't, as a beneficiary, I can't roll over something from my dad IRA.
Back to yours.
Back into mine, or even into an inherited IRA. It's got to be done sort of trustee to trustee kind of stuff. So you know, you got to be proactive. If you're somebody, one of the listeners is involved in an aunt who died and they're going to be the beneficiary, they need to make sure that, hey, did she have a retirement plan? And I don't want the money. I want it to roll over into my inherited IRA.
At least that way you have control over
timing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. What about, speaking of IRAs, there's been a lot of wailing and gnashing of teeth this year with people who are over age 70 and a half. The IRS compels them.
The pesky required minimum distribution.
Exactly. And, of course, those of us in the investment field, we love to use acronyms, so we like calling them RMDs. It makes us sound smarter. But it's just the amount of money that the IRS says you've got to remove. And, in fact, the IRS doesn't care. They don't care whether you take cash or securities. Just take anything. But you got to do something every year. Many times, if you're over age 70 and a half, for the last 2 or 3 years, you've been able to fulfill your required minimum distribution with your, and combine that with your gift to your favorite charity, perhaps WVXU or Cincinnati Public Radio, WMUB.
Good suggestion, Chris.
Just I don't know, just kind of thinking. But this year, that had, you know, they hadn't pushed all the buttons to solidify that until, or has it been done? I saw it still hasn't been done yet, has it?
Still has not been done.
And so if you thought you could do that this year, you still shouldn't do it until Dave tells you to, or you feel lucky that it's going to be extended.
Well, I will say, so you're talking about a qualified charitable distribution, which, to go along with the RMD, we call it a QCD. But
QCD. So
qualified charitable distribution. Now, there are some custodians, IRA custodians, that will allow you to actually do that. So, for example, you can tell your IRA custodian right now, hey, I want to give $1,000 to my church.
And, or to WVXU.
Or to WVXU, yes, of course. And they will do it. And if Congress comes along in the next however many days and says, oh, QCDs are back in for 2014, then they'll report it as such on the 1099. If they don't, they'll just treat it as a normal IRA distribution. So there's almost no, other than the paperwork hassle of doing it, you know, we've had a number of clients who have said, just do it. You know, there's no downside.
What's the benefit of doing a qualified charitable distribution versus just writing a check out of your regular checking account?
You know, the way the tax rules work, at least in Ohio, they're really the only benefit is in Ohio for most people, because, you know, what happens is the qualified charitable distribution with the charity is not considered a taxable IRA distribution, but you don't get a charitable deduction. So the impact on taxable income is zero. Now, it does impact gross income, which impacts a whole bunch of other things, phase-ins and phase-outs. So it's still probably worth doing. There's a couple cases where it's absolutely worth doing. If you don't itemize.
Okay.
Right? Because then you get it out of your AGI, but you still get your 14.6 standard deduction or whatever. So that's a slam dunk. But the other one is still, in terms of year-end planning, if you have highly appreciated securities that you can give to charity, that's better than a QCD. So if you've got P&G stock you inherited from grandpa at $2 a share and it's worth 90, give that away first. Don't do the QCD.
Okay.
Dave, while we're talking about IRAs, can I contribute a lump sum to my IRA now or before April 15th if I also have a 401k?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, you know, the normal rules about 5,500 or 6,500 if you're over 50, and there's all these complicated AGI limits depending on whether you're, you know. So there's the short answer is yes. Anybody who has wages can contribute to an IRA. Whether it's deductible or not, or whether you want to put it in a Roth or not, is where it gets a little complicated. Yes.
Now, if you use a Roth, there really isn't a present-day tax advantage, correct? That's something that will come down the road, and when you finally start taking the money out of the Roth, that's where you get your advantage, correct?
Correct. Okay. But I'm a big Roth fan. I mean, I'm sort of anybody under the age of 45, almost absolutely, if they can do a Roth, should rather than a regular IRA.
And this is where you'd want to buy your winemakers, shares in publicly traded winemakers, so you could have the grapes of Roth. Sorry.
Okay.
Actually, speaking of Roth,
we should explain the difference between a Roth and a traditional.
Sure.
Because that's a key point.
It's a big thing.
Yeah.
So the beauty of the Roth is that all future gains, when you take them out, will not be taxed.
They're tax-free and not tax-deferred.
Tax-free, not tax-deferred. So an IRA, you get a deduction going in, assuming it's a deductible
IRA.
But
guess what? The IRS wants its money at some point,
exactly,
right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the other big difference, and we're talking about the RMDs, this is a big difference. For regular IRAs, you must take required minimum distributions. For Roth IRAs, there is never a requirement during your lifetime.
What happens, though, we just discussed a stretch IRA and an inherited IRA. What happens to a Roth IRA when the owner of that asset goes on to their eternal reward? Can the beneficiaries of that continue to stretch it out indefinitely? Or at some point, does the IRS say, okay, game's up?
It's essentially the same rules, but it's – so you get the same – meaning that if grandpa owned that Roth IRA that he gave to his grandson or daughter – they have to start taking it out the first year following his death.
So a beneficiary Roth IRA is subject to those required
exactly.
minimum distributions.
But it's all tax-free to the beneficiary.
Okay, instead of taxable.
Yeah. So a stretch Roth is like the greatest wealth transfer tool in the world. I mean, to some degree, it's hard to beat.
It's the Swiss Army knife of financial.
I have a very interesting mental image going on right now.
You know, the other thing is that we run into a lot in our practice is that many times you'll have someone passes away, for example, and a couple, and there's a surviving spouse, and they have 1 year where they can still file jointly. Mm-hmm. You may have had one partner pass away in January. You've got the rest of the year. Still can file jointly. And they're in a higher bracket. They don't hit that 25% tax bracket until they get to $73,800 of taxable income. Mm-hmm. Have you seen a lot of people say, well, let's start converting pieces of this IRA account, or even if it's both husband and wife, if you're under that $73,800 umbrella, let's take money out and accelerate money from the traditional IRA and move it over to a Roth while we are mm-hmm. still in that 15% bracket? Has that been something that you've been seeing a lot of?
Yes. Particularly folks, you know, sort of right after retirement but before 70 and a half. So depending on when somebody retires.
That window between retirement and age 70 and a half.
Right, because at 70 and a half, you know, the RMDs kick in and you can't control your gross income quite as much. But, yeah, there's definitely opportunity for planning there.
More with Chris DeSimeo and David Foster after the break, and we'll take your calls at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, along with Chris DeSimeo and David Foster. As we talk about tax tactics that you can do before the end of this year, that could make a big difference when you file next year, you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. Email your questions to talk at WVXU.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Dave, we've been talking a lot about people who have investments and have assets, but what kind of year-end advice would you give to a working couple that has no investments at all? What kinds of things should they be doing before the end of the year?
Well, as it relates to, I guess the obvious one is, you know, look at their, try to do a cash flow projection, look at what their earnings are, and see if they can figure out a way heading into 2015 or even before the end of the year to begin to set aside some funds into something. You know, whether they're just saving $25 a month into a savings account, something to build an emergency savings, just a little planning to try and set aside some money. You know, if they can start to do that, then maybe they can fund a Roth, you know, at the end of 2015 with a couple $100. I mean, it's amazing how, you know, especially if you're younger, a couple $100 in a Roth 1 year and then 300 in that. I mean, you don't have to put 5,500 in for it to be meaningful.
You're just starting somewhere. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they have until their filing date to actually get the account funded and have it count on this return.
And it's a case of you have till April 15th to fund it, but it doesn't hurt to start funding now. I mean, you can take advantage of the growth between now and April anyhow that would occur, right?
The trickiest thing, honestly, is like finding, if you want to do a Roth, it's finding a custodian that will take a really small Roth and not charge you a $50 transaction card, you know, or a $50 annual fee. So, I mean, but you could look around on the internet or you could talk
a lot of good online options.
Yeah. But that you don't want to open up, won't name names, but, you know, and get a $250 fee for a $150 Roth.
Yeah. That would be a nasty surprise. Mm-hmm. Let's talk with Lynn in Milford. Good afternoon, Lynn. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Hi.
Lynn, what's your question?
The question was, is anybody aware of the fact that when you move IRA funds into Roth, if it puts you over the limit and you're retired, over this, I believe the cap is $70,000 or $80,000. If your conversion funds go into your gross income on your 1040 and there's no distinction as to income or transfer into a Roth, and so it can double your medication deductions from your Social Security.
Okay, so what Lynn is saying is, it's a really good point, is this, there's this Medicare Part B thing out there for 65 and over crowd that, you know, it might be $140 a month if your gross income is up to, you know, whatever number. And if you just go over that number, maybe it's $120,000 by a dollar. Oh, well, your Medicare Part B just went from 140 to 200. You know, $60 a month for each person. You know, so the it doesn't show up in any tax planning program anywhere. So everybody does need to be aware of that. That you can do things, be it a Roth conversion, be it selling
or
a capital gain.
Even a capital gain will could trigger
anything.
That then.
You know, it's I will tell you, it's, I've learned the hard way with a couple of clients over the years where you do something and you get up into the higher numbers like $250,000 of AGI and it, you know, they're paying $400 a month, Medicare Part B, husband, wife, that's $800 a month. That's $9,600.
Is that forever or just for the remainder of that tax year? And then it would go away when you reset at the beginning of the next year? Or is that just a permanent reduction?
No, it resets every year based on like the prior year tax return. So like 2015 Medicare Part B premiums will be based on the 2013 tax return.
Okay.
So what's crazy about it is it's, you know, the marginal effect is huge, meaning like as Lynn, if you just go over by a dollar, it puts you into this new you know, Medicare Part B premium category. So, yeah, it's something to be watchful
now,
for.
Is that something, though, also, and this is a great question, Lynn, thanks for calling, because in the case of Roth conversion, if you convert money from your traditional IRA to a Roth and then you realize that, oh, whoops,
yep,
maybe I shouldn't have done that, you can unconvert. Would unwinding part of that conversion help with the Medicaid reduction?
Yes, absolutely. And that really is what makes the point you make there, Chris, is what makes a Roth conversion so great, because you can – it's one of the few things we can come back later and say, oh, nope, I didn't really want that much. I wanted a little less, and you just roll it back.
It's like saying, "I can. May I buy a vowel?"
Yeah, exactly. It works.
We had a call from Martha in Dayton, Dave, and her question was, what about a same-sex couple that's married, legally married in one state, but they live in Ohio where the marriage is not recognized on a legal basis? What kinds of things should they be considering at this point?
Hmm. You know, I honestly don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what. I mean, I think they're, for federal tax purposes, they're considered married.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can file jointly and all that. Ohio, actually, you're better off filing separate in Ohio anyway, and kind of a fluky thing. Most states aren't like that, but in Ohio, they don't penalize sort of married filing separate. It's actually better to file two separate returns. So I might take advantage of that.
For your state taxes?
Just for the state of Ohio.
But sometimes...
Federal, joint.
Yeah.
But they can file jointly at the federal level.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
513-419-7100 if you have any questions. Let's talk with Daniel in Montford Heights. Good afternoon, Daniel.
Hi, good afternoon.
And what's your question?
Well, my wife and I are, I'm 70, my wife and I are considering establishing a trust fund for our children, and we have money in an account with the...
Which shall remain nameless. This is public radio.
That's okay. Proceed, Daniel.
Okay.
Just don't mention any names beyond that.
Yeah.
Okay, we have money in a program where it cannot go into a trust, so therefore we have to withdraw the money. And taxes have not been paid on it. So I understand we have to take it out of that place, and we're concerned what we should do with the money,
so
where it should go.
You have monies that are in an IRA account that have never been taxed?
That's correct.
Well,
it's not really an IRA account. Similar.
Well, I mean, I would think long and hard before I took money out of an account, like some sort of a retirement account where there's a tax penalty, essentially. Not really a penalty, but you have to pay tax to pull it out to put it into a trust. I'm not suggesting putting it in the trust isn't a good idea, and you're right in that you cannot retitle trusts in the name of a trust or retitle IRAs into a trust or any kind of a retirement plan. But boy, I'd be much more comfortable naming the trust potentially as a beneficiary of the IRA if that's what you really wanted. So, Daniel, I would sort of rethink the strategy.
Yeah. And if they were to do that, Dave, then you could leave the money in the retirement plan, whatever kind it is, whether it's an IRA or a tax sheltered annuity, a Section 403, or a deferred comp plan. You can name the trust as a beneficiary.
Mm-hmm.
And so the trust rules, whatever you want in that trust will guide what happens to it when you're gone,
right,
without triggering the taxable event of getting it in there while you're still alive.
Right, right, exactly. Or, you know, you could take out some reasonable amount every year and fund the trust with some, either the required minimum distribution, or if you want to go over that but not like all of it, you could take some out every year and put it in the trust and, you know, see what happens.
Great question, Daniel.
Yeah, very good. Thank you, Daniel. We appreciate the call. Dave, what about making sure you got your quarterly taxes paid, making sure you have the majority of what you might owe paid before the end of the year? That's a crucial thing that a lot of people miss because what's the IRS requirement? You have to have 90% of your taxes paid before filing, or there's a penalty that will come at that time?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's 90% of the current year tax or the prior year tax, but then a little more if you made a lot of money. So, but there is a safe harbor that as long as you pay the prior year tax or 110% of the prior year, you're okay. But yeah, you should be looking at that, you know, as the year goes on. The most important thing, though, from a tax planning standpoint at this point is looking at your state tax and maybe prepaying that before December 31st So if you live in Ohio and you do an estimate and you think you're going to owe, you know, $8,000 and you've only paid in six, you might want to pay in the final two before the end of the year.
There's an advantage to paying your property tax ahead of time, too, isn't there? You can deduct that if you pay it before
the end of the year? Okay. Same thing. But it comes with a big asterisk, which is the alternative minimum tax.
Yes. Oh. So if your income exceeds a certain level, your property taxes are no longer deductible.
Correct. And not just your income. I mean, yeah, your income exceeds a certain level and is a certain type. I mean, so, again, we got to say, run the numbers. Get TurboTax, talk to your accountant or your enrolled agent or something. But if you're in AMT, then that whole thing I just talked about, doesn't help you.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. And let's talk with Edward in Kettering. Good afternoon, Edward. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you very much. Mike, I'm interested in what you had to say about passing on Roths to children or grandchildren. And I think we may be in that situation. I'm also curious about the relative advantageousness of perhaps setting up life insurance policies for grandchildren and doing that possibly in place of a Roth, if that makes any sense.
Well,
lots of furrowed brows here.
Yeah. I would tend to, you know, of course, the issue with a Roth is that you're, unless you're going to do a big conversion, you're limited to how much you can put in there, right? If you're still working, $5,500 a year or $6,500, depending on your age. So there's a natural limit to that. Now, obviously, with life insurance premiums, if somebody had significant investable assets, they can put lots of money in there. I tend to try and keep life insurance sticking in the area of filling an economic need, like the family needs life insurance,
yeah,
and not filling an investment kind of need.
Would this also be something that you were considering buying insurance on yourself or on your grandchildren?
Well, we have both, actually. We've already purchased life insurance on our grandchildren, but we have purchased a second-to-die life insurance policy, mm-hmm, in part to, instead of purchasing long-term care insurance,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we don't think we're ever going to need that policy. We don't think we'll ever have to borrow or use our cash value as collateral to borrow against the money in the life insurance policy. And we think that it will be inherited, mm-hmm, by our children, possibly our grandchildren. And I'm wondering whether inheriting a policy might be as advantageous or perhaps even more advantageous than inheriting a Roth.
Well, certainly, you know, the death benefit that will be paid at the second death is tax-free. Yep. So in that sense, it's the same. You know, the difference really is probably potential growth between now and then. You know, I mean, obviously a Roth is invested in whatever you've decided to invest it in. It could go up, could go down, whatever. The life insurance, depending on the type it is, if it's a whole life policy or something.
Could be a variable universal life.
Yep,
could be
yep,
anything.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the kind of thing I guess I would, yeah, there's no reason to think it's not going to be a wonderful asset that would pass on to grandkids.
And he could even, if you are worried about some of the one of your beneficiaries potentially not being able to handle it well, you could set up a trust and mm-hmm. have it manage that, or you could even set it up so that one of the beneficiaries receives the money as a lifetime income while the other beneficiaries who might be better with mm-hmm. money get a lump sum.
Edward, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. Let's talk with John in Grosbeck. Good afternoon, John. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I have a question. I contribute to both a Roth and a standard IRA through work. If you already said this, I missed it. Can you give me an idea on the annual contribution limits for each type?
So how old are you?
I'm 50.
50? Okay. So
yeah.
So through work, is it when you said an IRA, or are you doing a 401k through your employer?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I guess that would be correct.
Okay. So that's 17.5. Assuming there's no, you know, there may be possible limits through your employer, but let's ignore that. The IRS says you can defer up to $17,500.
If you're under 50. If you're under
50. Oh, yeah, you're 50. Yeah. So yeah. That's an extra $5,500 bucks?
Yeah. 23 grand.
23,000 to the 401k plus 6,500 to the IRA.
Okay. Because it looks like I'll be able to contribute some additional lump sum payment to a Roth, which was my choice, shortly. And I'm trying to figure out how to go about doing that.
Save till it hurts.
Yeah, that's the way I felt.
You mean contribute to the Roth, like a Roth 401k through your employer, or just?
Well, I'm not sure. I assume because I already contribute through them. I didn't know how the proportion that I contribute through my employer would affect a one-time lump sum injection by me.
Well, just remember that the lump sum injection can't be any greater than the limit. Let's say it's, you know, if it's outside the
plan,
yeah, you're still limited at $6,500. Yeah.
John, okay. Thank you. We appreciate the call very much.
Take care.
So real quickly in the closing seconds, final thoughts, prepare ahead, right? Make sure you're crossing all your T's, dotting all your I's before April 15th and before the end of the year. Right, David?
Yeah, put the pencil to the paper, talk to a trusted advisor. I mean, you know, it's always better to work from a place of knowledge than just sort of winging it.
Absolutely. So you don't get any unexpected surprises.
Mm-hmm.
David and Chris, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Very welcome.
David Foster, Senior Vice President at Foster & Motley, and local financial advisor Chris DeSimio. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's program was Pete Reitmeier. The technical director was Kevin Rawinski. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Science Friday next on 91.7.